Well, God bless you all again here this evening. It's good to be back. Now, I already shared my testimony from my conversion on somewhat, and so that only leaves the bad part. And I struggle a little bit with that. It's been a while, I guess, since I've shared my testimony in this kind of way. But there's a few reasons why the last few times I've been asked to share my testimony in this kind of way, I've turned it down, actually. And I've struggled since then a little bit. One of the main reasons is because people tend to think people like me need more of Jesus than people that are not like me. And I hear people say things like, "Wow, you really did need Jesus." And so it makes other people look good, and maybe they don't need really as much of Jesus as what they thought. And obviously that's very damaging. It could be very damaging. And also another reason is because we all need Jesus the same. We all need to see our sin the same despite what that sin is. If you don't hate your sin like I hated mine, you'll never be freed from your sin. There's a good chance of that. And then if you are somehow freed from that sin, you'll never appreciate your freedom from that sin very much. He that has forgiven much loveth much, and I think that forgiveth much can be however badly you hated the sin that you're in. And bondage is bondage despite what the bondage is. So we all need a similar testimony as I'll share here tonight, despite what or how you were raised. And it could be, and some of my preaching in the last couple years since we got back from Haiti has been focused on that. When you're born in a Christian home and the standard of Christianity is to be a good person and, you know, this, that, and the other, and it's not to just be sold out for Christ, you can fit in pretty good until there's something that happens that's going to require Jesus. And then we fail. So we all need the same thing. We need to recognize our sin. We need that recognition breaks us, and then we desire to be free from it. But another reason why I agreed to and justify telling my testimony and going into maybe some more detail than I would like or have done in a long time is because I believe that we can get to a place where we no longer believe that God can save people that are in a rough spot. And whether we want to believe it or not, that affects how we live. That affects how we talk to people that we run into. It affects how we do everyday things. Then all of a sudden we start venting people that we witness to, and we don't give people that have a real, real troubled past as much attention as we would someone that was maybe a little more well off growing up. So just to remind us that people that are in a pretty dark spot, you know, I would get criticized in Haiti for preaching and witnessing and going to gangsters' houses by Anabaptist people. There was Anabaptist people accusing me of supplying gangs with weapons, you name it. Why else would he be in their homes? But I would go into these homes and I would see people that needed Jesus, and maybe more so, or they were better candidates than most people because they never had a chance. The only thing they ever had in their life was negative influence. And so why would they not be a better candidate instead of someone that's heard it over and over again, rejected it, sat through revival meetings 2 times a year for 20 years, went to church every Sunday, was taught this and that, and doesn't really have a desire to serve Jesus. These people that are in bondage often want to be freed from their bondage, but they don't know how. And so if this testimony can only do that, I would be satisfied. If it only encourage us next time we're in the inner city And we're talking to people that are way out, that Jesus died for them. God wants to save them just like he does our own children. And God can do it. The power of sin is another reason I like to share my testimony in this fashion, this way. We often underestimate the power of sin, and I want us to be aware of that through this testimony. It's a trap. There's a trap that the enemy of our soul sets. It's just like fishing. You use something that looks attractive, and we bite it, and there's a hook in there. And oftentimes, if you listen to people's testimonies, like you'll hear tonight, there is a strong desire to not be drug in that direction by this hook. And you're fighting against it, but the powers are too great, and you're sucked in to terrible situations. And so an encouragement to people that will never, ever do any of the things you hear tonight, these ungodly things, these shameful things, an encouragement to you to not start in the tiniest little thing. Because if this hook gets you, it'll take you where you don't want to go. And it's not at all worth messing around with. But I was raised going to church, and I don't have a lot to say about that other than I was not attracted to it. And I think that's interesting because I think the gospel should be attractive to our children. There should be something that mommy and daddy have that our children want to have also. Because the world is going to try to be attractive to our children. It was Finney that said, whoever is more attractive is going to win our children, the church or the world. That's a pretty alarming thing. When our churches are not attractive, what's going to happen to our children? And when we say attractive, I mean spiritually alive and attractive. But it seemed like there was nothing supernatural going on. Going through the motions. Hypocrisy. We talked about it a little bit over lunch today, but you know, two people fighting all the way to church, then get to church and hold hands going in. And obviously this isn't what we want. But we didn't understand. Didn't really care. I think it's just the best way I can explain it. Didn't really care. You know, this is where I'm at. It's unfortunate. But we didn't want that. We didn't see anything that was attractive. And so it naturally, that if someone's in that position, they naturally will rebel against it. Whether they really want to or not. And then I was arrested at a young age, and I was, I couldn't remember how old I was, me and Benji together, but I'm almost thinking that we weren't even teenagers yet. Could have been around there at some point. But it was the first of 17 times that I would be arrested before I was an adult. Of course, I didn't know that at that time. But it was a spirit of rebellion that I remember at that young age wanting to be addicted to things. I remember that clearly. Strange. But I remember slamming a case of warm beer just for that purpose. And that's not normal. It's not a normal thing. So that kind of lifestyle at a young age obviously led to things that were not good. I was thinking that when Brother John said he felt guilty the first time driving a car, I felt guilty too, but it was because I was 12 or 13 years old. And I wrecked a few cars in those young years. And if I think about those times of just recklessness, carelessness, and rebellion, you would think that it would be enough to wake a young boy up. But it was not the case. I wrecked a couple cars well over 100 mile an hour, and the one that comes to mind here tonight was I'd already wrecked a car at 110 mile an hour. In most vehicles, their governors will shut the car off at 110, And so that's as fast as you can go. And I knew that, so that's as fast as I would go. And I flipped a car end over end through a field. And I remember after the car had come to a rest, the car was on its top. I was clear in the back. You know, the car was a mangled piece of metal. But I could look out across this field that we were in, or that I was in, and I could see cars stopped along the road, and I could see people standing on the road. And I remember thinking, why aren't these people coming to help me? And I was somewhat trapped back there, but I tried to, so I started to crawl out with my arms. I had no feeling below my waist. And so I was trying to crawl out of this mess of a car, and as soon as I started moving, all these people came running to the car. And it was out in the field quite a ways. And as we were waiting for the ambulance there, I asked one of them why it took so long to come out to me, and they said, we all thought for sure you were dead. And they had watched the whole accident happen. But an ambulance did come then and took me to the hospital, and they told me that I would never walk again, that I injured my back and I would be paralyzed from the waist down. And I remember thinking how terrible, I was just devastated. And I've since forgotten about a lot of that, and just till 2 weeks ago, just to add this, I was struggling with going and preaching somewhere, and I was thinking, you know, we've been traveling a lot, and it's, you know, we kind of got, you know, I really wasn't desiring to go, and I was in prayer time, and it was like God said, do you remember that accident? You were paralyzed, and I gave you your legs back, but your legs are for me. And it really humbled me. But yeah, there I was, and I remember they even told my mother. My mother came, and they told her that I would not walk again. But obviously I did. I started to have feeling back in my legs and fully recovered from that. And it was some years later that I was having back pain at my workplace, and they did an x-ray of my back, and he said he couldn't believe that I was walking. My bottom vertebrae in my back was completely shattered, and it healed that way, and there was arthritis all over. And so I've had some back issues since then, but that's pretty well cleared up for now. But just that lifestyle of just recklessness, and I got out of the hospital and didn't stop a minute. So drugs and alcohol were a big part of my life growing up. Just, there was no limit. Just a out of control would be a good word for it. And influences, people that were a part of my life that shouldn't have been, public school, just a mess. Well, we started playing football there in the seventh grade, and that seemed to be a bright spot, something to change my ways. And me and Benji joined the football team there, and he was the quarterback, I was the running back, and we were doing well. But that's when I realized that I didn't have control of this thing. I had a temper problem, an anger problem. And when I was 12, I was put on anger management medication. And I would take a pill every day. And it was supposed to fix my problem. And it didn't seem to really do anything, I didn't think. But they said if you would stop taking it, then you'll find out what it was doing. So I never did stop taking it I took it for 6 years. But just a temper problem, fighter, just demonic is the word that comes to mind. Just angry, seemed to just struggle to do anything right. I was 16 when I found out that I was going to be a father. And I remember thinking, I was devastated. Well, I didn't believe it at first that when it came to be, it was going to be that was a factual thing. I remember thinking that I'm in not any position or place to be a father, but I wanted to take that responsibility. But I realized that I was addicted to things. I was addicted to multiple things, and I was in bondage, and it's just the way it was. I already had a bad record, run-ins with the law, And the only thing I had going for me was football. But my coach would, I would get arrested, and my coach would cover it up. Until finally, some people in the athletic department seen it in the newspaper, and it was reported, and I was kicked off the team. And so that was, there was things like that, a lot of things like that in my life, where there was a bright spot, but it would always, I would always destroy it. It would come to an end, and it would devastate me. But I always had vices to go to. I always had drugs and alcohol and different things. Then I found, I was actually in Canada partying when I heard that a friend of mine said, I heard that you're a father now. And that, yes, that's how it went. There was a baby was born that night. And I was thinking that seeing my child would be enough to change me. And I still think that there was a chance of that, but I went back and I held my baby girl in my arms, and I remember thinking that I was going to change. Things were going to be different. But her mother decided to take the baby and leave the state, claiming that I was unfit and dangerous, a danger to the child. And that was extremely hard for me. And so I actually got the police involved, and there was a warrant issued for her arrest, but they never did find her. The next 4 years, nobody knew where she was with my daughter. So I decided that I was always confident that someday I would get a chance to go to court to have custody of my daughter. But I always thought that there was no way that any court would give me custody with my record and just my life. And I remember coming to that conclusion that if I would be given an opportunity, if the police would find her, if whatever the case was, and I found out later the police weren't really looking for her, but if the opportunity would come, you know, and then I would go to court and lose any custody of her, how devastating that would be. So I decided after high school to join the Marine Corps, thinking that that could turn this whole thing around. That I could come home from the Marines some years later and I'd be an honorable person, and I could win the custody of my daughter. So that's what I did. Out of high school, I joined the Marine Corps, and I think it's interesting that you know, I share this some, and when we talk about unity in the church, and we talk about structure in the church, have we ever related it to the military? I did it once, and I was rebuked for doing it, and I don't have it written down to do it again. But I remember very clearly at the end of, you know, so you sign up for the military, and you know, the recruiter is a liar. He is just trying to get you to sign up. I mean, he feeds you the biggest line ever. Everything he said was a lie. Just amazing. But then when you start to realize that, it's too late. So anyhow, I was on this bus going to Paris Island, South Carolina for boot camp. And I got on this bus, and this big Greyhound bus, and it's in the middle of the night. And we'd been waiting forever to get on this thing. It's all designed to wear you out, and it's a government thing. And so you're on this bus, and there was 92 of us on this bus, and everybody's chatting and talking and telling stories about their whatever. Everybody's got their own identity. People all look different. People have long hair, ponytails, shaved heads, beards, no, you know, everything you can think of. Everybody's got different clothes on. And then all of a sudden, we parked this bus after driving around for hours. We parked this bus, And the door opens and these drill instructors come charging onto this bus. I mean, like demons released from a cage. I mean, screaming, and it's terrifying. And so now all of a sudden, what happened to the demeanor of us on that bus? I mean, silence, fear. No one cared about what they were just talking about. No one cared about their anything. It was quite something. And we get forced, and we're just like puppies at this point. We get forced out of this bus. There's a huge sign there, probably 80 feet long, that says, we do not promise you a rose garden. We did not promise you a rose garden. And I was thinking, yeah, you kind of did promise a rose garden. But from that point on, for the next 3 months, it is pretty intense, wearing down. And you don't know at the time, but that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to break us. And then 3 months later, and Benji was there, 91, one of them didn't make it, 91 people come marching out of this tunnel. They all look exactly the same. The same everything. Same colors, polished. Their rifles are all held exactly the same. Their steps are exactly the same. They're marching to a cadence. Everything is perfectly the same. Everything they do is the same. They move their weapons the same, all together. And that's 3 months. They broke you down, and they built you something else in you. That's their design. And then they say, after this, this group of people is ready to go fight a war. They wouldn't have said that about us 3 months prior, right? And it's almost like, I know we can't relate that exactly to the church, but we can glean something from that, can we not? When we're united, things can happen. But when we're individualistic, when it's about me and what I think and all that, we're not fit for anything in the kingdom either, I don't believe. And it seems like the government has figured that out. So yeah, it was quite a journey there in the Marines. But I decided I was gonna make the best of it, and so I did. And I was a part of a company of 1,400 Marines, and I was the very top of that list in testing and scores throughout our training days. And my desire was to be the best that there was in the Marines, and I was achieving that, and everything was going good. But the reality was I was still addicted. I was still in bondage. But I was getting pretty good at doing it without anybody knowing. And the reality was I needed these things to live. I needed alcohol to live. I needed drugs to live. I needed these things. And I didn't ever admit that. I would get arrested, and I would act like I'd never done it before. And I would always get off somehow. But I'd spent a lot of time in counseling in my teenage years and alcohol rehab places and that. But then the Marines kind of had a slogan of play hard, work hard, that type of thing. You know, a bunch of rough characters, and it would get pretty rough when it could. So you get some time off, and you could go out and do what you wanted, and it was a pretty crazy time. But I instantly, you know, gained a reputation during those times. And like, for instance, I remember, you know, we just go out and just cut loose. I remember one of the younger Marines said, "Hey, I want to videotape you from when you leave all the way through this night. And I want to post it on YouTube and label it The Drunkard. And we'll try to make a TV show out of this." I remember that. I was like, yeah, whatever. So he was following me through that whole night, videotaping me. It was just a normal night. And the mornings that I would wake up, I would have no recollection of what happened the night before. And it was the same for this night. But I woke up the next morning, and my head was throbbing something incredibly fierce, not a hangover throb. But my entire pillow, I was in my bed, and my entire pillow was soaked in blood. And I remember feeling my head, and I had a huge cut all the way down the back of my head. It was a nasty thing. And so I went and just started drinking right again, right there. I didn't know what happened. And someone came in and told me that, hey, you know, there's a video of you going around of what happened last night. So this video, it showed me starting the night, and from the night, from the beginning to the end, I consumed 56 beers. And smoking stuff and doing all manner of things. And I remember watching this and just thinking, it made me angry. But the control that this stuff had on me became so evident. And it got to the point where we were in the second floor of a club, and it was just discouraging watching me in the state that I was in. And I'm going backwards, and I go right out of a door, and there's no stairs. It's like a side of a building without stairs going to the door. The door was unlocked, wasn't supposed to be. And I fell and landed on my head on the sidewalk. And just laid there in a pool of blood. Nobody really wanted to do anything. Finally, I'm thrown in the back seat of my own car, and someone drives me back, puts me in my bed. And so I stayed there for several days until I felt the back of my head swelling. In fact, my ears were touching the back of my head. So I decided I needed to go to the doctor, and they said it's swelling on the brain, and they were going to monitor it for 2 days, and they gave me medications, and they said basically if the swelling doesn't go down, we're going to have to do surgery. But the swelling did go down. In fact, I never went back for that next checkup. But things like that, just crazy situations. I remember another time, close to that time, I was out partying with people, and the guy that I got a lot of my drugs from, he was, well, let me back up a little bit. I was able to still be a very effective Marine outside of this. Nobody would have known, none of my superiors would have known this was me. If they would ever have seen that video or whatnot. But there was a complaint that the underage drinking in the barracks was getting out of control. Everyone knew that you could drink in the barracks underage. It wasn't a big deal. But there was things, and I was probably to fault for some of these things, but there was things happening that were getting out of control, so they were going to try to stop. They issued a warning that the underage drinking had to stop. Well, no one really listened. And so I was watching an Ohio State, North Carolina State football game on a Saturday morning, just nice, calm morning, and I was just drinking a few beers that morning, and they came in. The military police came in, and they put me in handcuffs. I remember I was shocked, and took me to a jail cell. And this couldn't be happening. You know, I was an upstanding Marine. I had rank. I'd climbed the ladder faster than anybody else that joined with me, and I was being treated like this. And everybody else was doing what I was doing. In fact, there was somebody else in the room with me that was just left there. And then a few days later, they took me out, and they brought me in front of the whole squadron, and they removed all the rank from me for underage drinking in the barracks. And that was the turning point. And I look back at it now and I thought, if I could have just handled that maturely and understood, you know, what they were doing, may not agreed with it, it was unfortunate, but understood that they were trying to make a point and trying to set the record straight. But instead, I rebelled against that terribly bad. And I never got any rank back. I was fighting against the system from that point on. So I cut loose, and I was a very bitter person at that point, and I just, it was a bad decision. But I also think that maybe God had a hand in it, if that's possible, to remove me from that system. But I was with this guy that I got all my drugs from, and he was a nasty, he was also in the Marines, but he was kind of like me. He'd been court-martialed, his rank had been taken, and That's another thing. When they took my rank, they put me with people for 3 months that were just that had also been take their rank had been taken. So I was with child molesters. I was with drug addicts. I was with just a bunch of people just like me, I guess. And so that obviously didn't help things. But I was with this man, and we were out at the bars, and he said his girlfriend, who I'd never met, was coming that night. And he was talking real derogatory towards her to me before she came, you know, my old lady, and, you know, she'll do this for us and this, and just kind of upset me. But then when she came, it was late in the night, and he was just terrible to this young lady. I just really felt for her. Then we got in the car to go home, and he was in the back seat with her, and he hit her. And so I threatened the man and told him if he hit her again, I wasn't going to let him hit her again. And she just looked at me and said, "Barry, stay out of this. Stay out of this. He loves me. This is how he gets sometimes, but just leave it alone. You don't want to get in his way." And so I left it alone, and that night he killed that lady. And I seen him later in the brig. But just situations like that, the life of the sin, and it wears on you, even when you're a carnal, ruthless person. And there's something, but it was a bad deal. So I was in counseling all the time. They were trying to help me, the U.S. government. And they had the best counseling places. They had the best systems, and nothing worked at all. I remember one of the AA instructors was a big shot in a big church there, and he wanted me to come to church, and so I did. I was willing to do whatever it took. I wanted to be freed from this, I wanted to be freed from this addiction and all these things, but just nothing. I mean, I would stop drinking for weeks and stay clean of everything for a number of days at least. And people would say, "Hey, never mind. You need to start drinking again. Start drugging. This we don't like you this way." I was in a bad spot. But when none of that counseling worked, I remember I would take a fifth of Jack Daniels with me every morning. And drink it just while I was there at the station and wherever we were at, training, whatever. And there was a sergeant that I used to be higher ranked than him, and now obviously it was the other way around, and he was making me feel that. And I remember one day, we didn't get along, obviously. One day I kind of came to my senses and I was on top of him. Just pummeling him, and I drank some that morning, but it was nothing abnormal. But I still believe that an evil spirit, a demon, was in control of me. They pulled me off of him, and we were separated for a while. And then 2 days later, my gunnery sergeant, who I had a lot of respect for, he came and he said, "Hey, I want you to come with me. We got some business to take care of." And we went to Camp Lejeune, which is just a mile or two down the road. And went to this big building, and he walked me in there, and he said, "This will only take a few minutes." We went all the way to the top floor. I'll never forget, we walked up to this counter, and I instantly felt like something was wrong. This place was creepy. And we walk up to this dark counter, and there's a lady there looking at me and looking at him, and then my gunnery sergeant looked at me, and he said, "I'm sorry, Barry, but this is where you have to stay." And it was an insane asylum. And I felt betrayed, but at the same time, I don't know, a lot of feelings going through my mind. But I don't remember it getting violent there, but I remember them strapping me to a gurney where I couldn't move my arms and legs in this room and bright lights everywhere, and they hooked a bunch of machines up to me, and it was just a crazy situation. But anyhow, they kept me there for, I think, 6 weeks and declared that I was drug and alcohol dependent. And so I didn't understand that, but what that meant was I wasn't a bad person. I was a medical I had a medical situation. And so I didn't know at the time, but it would mean that people would treat me different than this rebel. They would treat me as someone that's got a medical situation, which probably wasn't good for me. So I said all the right things, and I got out of that place, and everything was exactly the same. It was a mess. It only got worse leaving there, and I marvel at just the... I remember after I got out of there, I was never going to do anything again. I was going to stay clean. And I was in my barracks room, having withdrawals and just going crazy. And my room, I was in there by myself, but the Marine in the next room, he just came in and he said, "I'm going to set your things that you need right here in the middle of your room, and I'm going to leave." And he set some drugs and a Corona beer there, and I lost the battle. And just like that, I'm back right where I was. But yeah, I did desire freedom, and I want us to know that. And I think we all desire freedom, no matter what the bondage is. We're not made to be bound people to any vice or any, no matter what it is, if it's frustration or anger or no matter what it is, we're not made to live and cope with that. We desire to be free, and that desire hopefully will lead us to the one that can free us. But for me, there was no power that could free me. There was no church had nothing to offer me. It was just that's just the way the sad truth of it in my mind. But I was I remember a night we were going from bar to bar. A bar would, we had like four bars that we'd go to, and they'd all close at different times. So when one would close, we'd go to the next one. And I was driving with my sergeant and a few other people that were higher ups, and it was real late or early in the morning, and I'm turning into this bar. It was a Wednesday night, and there's a car coming, and I'm extremely intoxicated. A car is coming, and I turn into this bar too quick, and I hit the tail end of this car. And I just see it spinning down the road, and then I see it wrap around a telephone pole. And I remember in the front end of my car was smashed in. But of course, you know, shock, everybody's don't know what to do, we're gonna get caught, we're all in a bad place. So I pulled in, and everybody that was in the vehicle got out. And I just said, "Hey, act like you weren't here, and we'll figure this out." And so that's what happened. And I just started driving. And I remember I called Benji, I think, that night and said, "I just killed people." I was devastated. It was I drove by the scene, and there was police, ambulances, fire trucks, and this car was completely wrapped around this telephone pole. And so I actually drove that car all the way back from North Carolina, all the way back to Ohio, and switched cars, and drove my older brother's car back to North Carolina, and just forgot about that whole thing. But I knew that they were looking for whoever did that. I didn't know what had happened to the people that were in the car. I don't know how long. I would say several months, if not 6 months, passed. And my gunnery sergeant, who always respected me because he's seen potential in me, he's seen how well I did when I wanted to do good or when I could do good, but he was there to try to help me at times. But the sergeant major of the whole base called me into his office one day, and he said, "What kind of car do you drive?" And right then I knew that it was about that accident. And I just said the kind of car that I had now, my brother's car. And the car that I was in the accident with was a white Grand Prix. The car I now had now was a Buick of some sort. And he said, "Did you ever own a white Grand Prix?" And I mean, I just get sick to my stomach. And I said, "No, I have no idea what you're talking about." He said, we have proof that you were involved in a deadly hit-and-run accident. And I remember just, thinking my life is over. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I was thinking there's no way he has proof unless one of those people in the car had turned on me. And there was a confrontation between me and one of those people just prior to that incident with him. And he said, listen, Barry, I'll just be honest with you. The state police are looking for you, and if we handle it inside the military, then they cannot handle it out there. It's double jeopardy. So if we handle it in here, it'll stay in the military. It'll stay in the Marine Corps, and we'll handle it in our courts. But if I turn you over to them, then we're staying out of it, and they'll handle it, and you'll never see the light of day again, he said. And I bit into that. I said, okay, it was me. And he didn't say one more word. He called the state police and said, he's here. You can come and get him. So the police came. They arrested me, drove me to the jail. And I remember thinking that I'd never see the light of day again. A devastating thought. Just, I hated jail with a passion. I'd go there I was just there all the time, and I always hated it just as bad every time. But I get to the police station there, or they take me out into this interrogation room, and they talk to me, and I find out that no one died. There was some injuries, neck injuries, this and that. And long story short, I get some lawyers, and I beat that case. And I was kind of known for that, getting out of things, taking stuff to court. And so I actually was released, and I went back to the barracks. And the gunnery sergeant, no, the sergeant major, he thought that he'd never see me again as well. But the next day I seen him in a hallway in the office there, and his mouth just dropped open. And I just smiled at him, and that was not a good thing to do. But he decided to go back, and all the charges that were dropped, he picked them up and charged me with them in the military. And that was a little bit disappointing. But anyhow, I was going through that. But while going through that, I was on like house arrest. I had to remain on at the barracks. There was another name for it. I can't think what it was. But I was able to get around that thing, and I would still travel and do my drugs and all that. And all of a sudden, one night, my barracks room was raided by the military police, and I was arrested, taken in, and I was extremely high and intoxicated. And they did they tested me there, and they transferred me to the brig. And I was pretty messed up state, but then they court-martialed me again, and I tested. I can't remember the numbers. Last time I showed my testimony, I had these numbers, but the amount of cocaine that was in my system was higher than they'd ever seen in the military, U.S. military, by a long shot. And after I spent 6 months in the brig, I was released and terminated from the Marine Corps with a bad conduct discharge. And I got, so now I come back, and everything I went for obviously didn't turn out. I come back defeated, have a felony charge. I remember the last words that the sergeant major said to me was, McDonald's won't even hire you. And that's what I believe. That's what I thought. So I was pretty down, pretty discouraged. And I remember thinking it would be better if I just wasn't alive. And I'd had that thought times before. I remember I shut my car in the garage and sucked the exhaust fumes for over an hour, and nothing happened. Finally gave up. But this night I was thinking, you know, I wasn't allowed to have any guns. I didn't have any guns there. I remember thinking, what can I do? I was already intoxicated, just to painlessly end my life. And so I went to the medicine cabinet, and there was a big bottle of Tylenol. So I Googled if an overdose of Tylenol could kill a person. And it said yes. It said how many. This many can destroy this and that, and your body can shut down. It was like 30 doses of Tylenol. But I took the entire bottle, 500 tabs, extra strength Tylenol. And I really had a lot of confidence that I would not wake up. I woke up the next morning as if I didn't take any Tylenol. I didn't even have a stomachache. And things like that happened a few times. The discouragement and despair that I was in was a roller coaster. It was just I don't know how to explain it. But I was never to the point, believe it or not, I wasn't where I needed to be. I still had a bad attitude. I still was bitter. I was still proud in some senses. I know that doesn't make any sense, but still thought of myself more than I should have. Thought I deserved better. Just an interesting thing. My daughter did come back into my life, and we went through the court process, and it was just a disaster. The system was set up against me. When I say that without prejudice, but you know, she was the mom, I was the problem child. It was a no-brainer, and the mom simply wanted child support from me, didn't want me to be a part of the child's life. And but Kaylee, she was 4 years old at this point, and I just loved her. So we fought through years of court, just a court battle, and I ended up getting some time with her. But I realized that my addictions and my carnal lifestyle, I wanted more, or somehow I blew that with her. I'll just put it that way. And so everything was against, you know, it was just a bad deal. So that my life continued that way, and just partying and just defeat and alcoholism and drugs and just a bad, an ugly lifestyle. But you know, if you'd have seen me, I look happy. I have nice clothes on. I have a good job. Girlfriend, all that. So that this picture that I paint is an inward, it's a heart picture. And it's just, the bondage of all that. Then I was leaving a bar and had a woman with me. And I remember we were driving right through Fort Wayne, Indiana, right downtown. And she asked me for my ID. And I gave her my ID, and she took it and she threw it out the window. And I remember thinking, just kind of snapping at her. And there was a policeman that seen that happen. So this policeman pulls us over, and I get arrested for driving under the influence and taken to the Allen County Jail there. And I'm in this jail cell, and, I don't know if this is the next morning. I'd already talked to a lawyer, I think, or I tried to. I don't know. I was very intoxicated again. I'm not sure what all happened, but there was a black man in there with me. He had a big afro. His side of his face was all scraped up and bloody, and He said the police had tackled him, and he told me this big story about how he got arrested and hates the police. And then he got into this state where he was just pacing. We were there, you know, for a long time. He was just pacing back and forth in the cell, and all he kept saying was, "This isn't me. I don't belong here. This isn't me. I don't belong here. This isn't me. I don't belong here." Walking back and forth. And I'm tired of hearing them. I'm getting frustrated. And finally I said, "Man," I said, "this is you. You belong here." And then I said, "This isn't me. I don't belong here." I mean, and I wasn't joking. It's crazy. But it was like God had had enough. It was the tipping point, is all I can say. And God opened my eyes right at that moment. And I seen who I was. And I remember on that jail cell floor, my life passing before my eyes. All the people that I'd hurt. All of the evil, wicked things that I'd done. Terrible things. And I remember on that floor, hating myself more than I'd ever hated myself. I remember crying out to God, if he could change me. I can't change myself, and nobody else can change me. I've been to all the counseling. I've been to church. Church doesn't change me. I can't just start going to church and change the way I look or start doing things differently. I am bound, and I need something supernatural to happen to me. God, can you do that? That was my question. That was my plea. That was my prayer. If you can do that, if you can change this person, I want this person to be dead. I don't want him. I don't want to be him anymore. If you can do that, I'll serve you forever. The commitment is made. I'll go where you want. I'll say what you want. I'll do what you want. And over the next few days, God honored that. And he saved me, he changed me completely. I remember walking out on the porch of my house in the middle of the night. I'd been sober for several days, and everything was different. The trees were different. The street lights were shining through the trees. And I knew right then that God had changed me. I didn't know much about anything else, but I knew that I was freed from all of the sin and the vices. I was forgiven. I was a new person. And I look back at that time, and it wasn't a whole lot of faith. It was a desperation. It was a position of weakness, crying out for something supernatural to happen. And I wonder if we didn't have more of that in our churches. I know we don't find ourselves in the situation that I was in. But if we didn't have more desperate cries for something supernatural to happen, maybe when we're young, maybe if it wouldn't help us in some of the talks that we have and some of the discussions that we've even had this weekend. But there it was. I was a new creature, a new person, and I was excited about it. And there, in the same time, the same thing was happening to my brother Benji, and that's a miracle in itself. And I wonder how we would have done it without each other. I thought of that, and then my wife as well. When I met her, she was a huge help. But I was this new creature. Everything was different. I lost my license that night. I didn't think I had my license. Yeah, I did have my license before that. But the police obviously took him that night. And so people were driving me to work, and I still had penalties, or you know, I still had to reap some things that I was sowing. And I still had to go to court. And I remember thinking, one of my brothers bailed me out that night. It was Benji that bailed me out. I still had to go back to court, and I think it's an interesting testimony, this court thing. I had the thought that somehow, this is the wrong thought, but I had the thought somehow that I was no longer accountable to my actions prior to being converted. just in my mind that, you know, I don't have to go back and face these charges. I think there was an assault charge that night as well and different things. That somehow I can just, that whole thing is gone. That whole person, the whole lifestyle, the whole everything is gone. There's a new person and I no longer have to mess with them. But obviously that wasn't the case. I had to go back to court and they had changed the law just that same year. See, it was that was the eighth time I had been arrested for driving under the influence. And the thing was, there was some in North Carolina, there was some in South Carolina, there was some in Florida, there was some in Ohio, and this was the first one that was in Indiana. And each state dealt with their state. So these never piled up. But they just changed the law that year that now if you got a DUI anywhere in the country, it all counted together. They counted them together. And if you have, it's three strikes and you're out. If you get three DUIs, you lose your license forever. And I think it's either the fourth or the fifth DUI was a minimum 5-year prison term. And so now here I go into the eighth one. And so I was really, if God didn't intervene, I was going to spend quite a bit of time in jail there. So I had a lawyer, and the lawyer I'd had before, and I'd called him that night when I was in the jail. And so we went to court a few times and dealt with things, and it didn't look very good for me at all, but the day came for sentencing, and I remember I was in there with my attorney in the Allen County Courthouse, and there's two courtrooms, and we didn't know which one I was going to be in, courtroom one and courtroom two. And I had knew from previous encounters that there's a female that's in courtroom one, the judge, and the judge in courtroom two is a male. And he came and he sat down beside me and he said, "Barry, I want you to know that if we're called into courtroom one, which I don't even know myself right now, that you'll serve at least the minimum of 5 years. There'll be no, but there's a good chance that you'll serve more time than that." And so you know, let's hope that we're in courtroom two. And so we waited a while, and he came out, and he just said, "I'm sorry, but we're in courtroom one." This judge had had a family member killed by a drunk driver, and she was extremely ruthless with drunk drivers. And you know, and I understand that. But he just apologized, and we kind of just had a little solemn word, and then we went into the courtroom. And we sat there for a while, then he left the courtroom, and I was sitting there by myself, and I remember thinking, how can this be, God? I'm freed from all of these things. I'm no longer going to be doing any of those things. I now want to be a testimony and a light and an example to you. We'd already been out witnessing to people, and this new life was kicked in, and it was exciting. How can this all end, and I'm in prison? How can it be? And it was almost like God just said, "I have work for you in prison." I remember just sitting there thinking, maybe that's my calling, to be a witness in prison. And a peace came over me, and I was ready for whatever came. And it was exciting. But I sat there and sat there and sat there, and there's the recorder's sitting there with her type thing, and there's a prosecutor there, and everyone's just kind of doing their own thing. It's quiet. Outside, there's all kinds of commotion, people. And I can tell that the judge is not here. That the judge should walk in any time and call everybody to attention. Everybody stands up, and then the court's underway. And this just wasn't happening. And my lawyer's back sitting beside me, and he's looking at his watch and doesn't know what's going on. And finally, the doors open behind us. The judge always comes in a separate door up here and walks to her seat. The door opens behind, and a man walks in with several folders. He has blue jeans on and a sport suit coat over a shirt like this. And he just walks right up back, goes behind where the judge sits, and sits down. And he says, "We just got word that she cannot make it today." So we've canceled court for today, but we're gonna finish this one case. And I'll never forget, my attorney just went over and squeezed my knee. So we asked for the prosecutor and my attorney to approach the bench. And they went up there, and there was quite a conversation for quite a while they were talking this thing over. And he came back, they each came back to the seats, and my lawyer came back, and he was just smiling right at me. And I didn't know what was going on, but the judge said a few words and dismissed the case. And then stood up and walked out. And the bailiff came in, the same man that would come in and arrest me, came in, and he had my license plate. And he gave me my license plate that they must have took it off my vehicle. He gave it back, and he said, your license will be reinstated as of today, but it may take 24 hours for the DMV to get that record. So we don't advise you driving for the next 24 hours. And I'm speechless. And so we left the courtroom, and my lawyer looked at me, and he said, there was something supernatural in that building. And I don't know that he was a man that would profess to be a Christian or not. I can't remember. But I left. So I called my mom, and I didn't have no ride anywhere. I called my mom, told her to come pick me up, and she came and picked me up, and I decided to call the BMV just to see if my license was reinstated. And they said, we don't have any record that your license was ever suspended. So your license is good to go. And I marvel at that testimony because it was God commissioning me to go into the world. And I've always thought that, and I think it'd be good for all of us to think this way, that I'm on borrowed time. I'm a dead man walking. I'm supposed to be in hell 100 times over, forever. But God has saved me. He has changed me. And now what is my responsibility to that? Is it to just toe the line? Is it just to plug in and relax? Or is there more that God would have for me? And obviously, we can all say the same thing, can we not? We all can have the same testimony. So, the rest of the story I already told earlier today. We bounced around Protestant churches trying to find the people of God. Met my wife, got married. I got a hold of my daughter, and we were Protestant Christians, and my daughter was just thrilled that I was a different person. And she always wanted to be with us, and we'd go to church, and she was a big support. But just like with a lot of people, the closer we got to Christ, the less people liked us. Until it came to the point that that my daughter no longer felt comfortable around us. And And so there's always a cost. But if the cost is for Christ, is it not worth bearing? Is it not worth going through? And we can dwell on it, and I can think about things like my daughter and different things, and I can, yeah. But the reality is, and now me and my daughter are back in communication, and I don't know what God has. But the reality is, this life is but a vapor. It's just a tiny little time, and eternity awaits. And the more people that we can witness to and get to understand that this life is a vapor, and the power of God to free us from, you know, I never even thought about drinking or smoking. I smoked several packs of cigarettes a day for 15 years. And just, it's gone. I remember one time we were preaching, and someone lit up a cigarette on the street, and I smelled it, and I was attracted to it. And it shocked me. This was years later, first time it happened. And it was like God told me right then, you're not attracted to that. That's not you. It's the devil trying to get you to think that that's you. and we're new creatures. We're delivered. It's only the devil trying to get us to think that we're still struggling in those areas. And so a life of victory is my passion and desire to be an example. And I just pray that we can see the sin for what it is. It's an ugly thing. It's a nasty thing. I struggle to talk about it. I'm ashamed of it. But the reality that God saved me out of that is so encouraging for me when I'm working with people that are, you know, I share my testimony a lot with drug addicts and people on the street, and they're just amazed that, you know, God can. I was just sharing it last week with a man that he had just shot his gun. He'd gotten in a fight, and he pulled his pistol and started shooting. I just shared with him right in Indianapolis. You know, God can forgive you. There's things in your life that you probably don't think God can forgive you for. And he said, he said he'd killed people. I said, I guarantee you, if you repent. And I shared my testimony, and he's just amazed. He thinks that I'm just this born Mennonite person. But even as a born Mennonite person, we can share our testimony of the bondage of sin, whether it's rebellion, anger, frustration, bondage, and there's a freeing power. God bless you.